In a world that celebrates persistence and grit, Annie Duke's Quit offers a revolutionary perspective. Knowing when to walk away is just as crucial as knowing when to persevere. This counterintuitive wisdom has captivated readers across industries, with Nobel Prize winners Daniel Kahneman and Richard Thaler both praising its brilliance. The book has become something of a secret weapon among Silicon Valley executives and Wall Street traders who recognize that strategic quitting is essential to success. Even Serena Williams cited Duke's work when discussing her tennis retirement, acknowledging that the hardest decisions often involve knowing when to let go. As Duke, a former World Series of Poker champion turned decision strategist, cleverly puts it, "The opposite of a great virtue is also a great virtue." Her unique background bridges high-stakes poker with cognitive psychology, creating a framework that transforms how we think about life's most difficult decisions. Muhammad Ali's career perfectly illustrates the double-edged nature of grit. The same unwavering determination that fueled his legendary Rumble in the Jungle comeback against George Foreman in 1974 later drove him to fight 7 more destructive years despite clear medical warnings. His refusal to quit ultimately contributed significantly to his Parkinson's disease diagnosis. This paradox forms the book's central premise. The qualities that make someone successful can become their undoing when context changes, but behavior doesn't. Our cultural bias against quitting runs deep. We describe those who persevere with glowing terms like steadfast, resolute, and gutsy, while dismissing those who quit as deserters, wimps, and wusses. Even our cultural heroes reinforce this through quotes like, "Winners never quit." Our language itself reveals this bias. We've created numerous euphemisms like pivot and starting a new chapter to avoid the stigma of quitting. When Olympic skier Lindsey Vonn announced her retirement with a body broken beyond repair after multiple surgeries, she still felt compelled to declare, "I'm not giving up." Yet science tells a different story. Despite our cultural worship of perseverance, research consistently shows we tend to persist too long in losing endeavors. Even Angela Duckworth, whose book Grit celebrates persistence, recognizes the importance of quitting some pursuits to find what's worth sticking with. Nobel Prize winners Daniel Kahneman and Richard Thaler have extensively documented how humans over-persist in the face of bad news. The truth is that quitting isn't the opposite of grit. It's a complementary skill. Grit gets you up the mountain, but quit tells you when to come down. Success comes not from blind persistence, but from picking the right thing to stick to and quitting the rest. Like poker players who understand that folding mediocre hands is just as important as playing winning ones, we need to develop the wisdom to know when walking away is the right move. During the infamous 1996 Everest disaster chronicled in Into Thin Air, 3 climbers, Hutchison, Task, and Kosciuszko, made a decision that likely saved their lives. Despite being just hours from the summit, they honored their 1 p.m. turnaround time and descended safely. Meanwhile, their guide Rob Hall, who had previously enforced strict turnaround times, waited for a struggling client who reached the summit at 4 p.m. Both died on the mountain. Yet these 3 climbers who quit at the right time remain largely forgotten, while those who died are memorialized. This invisibility of successful quitters creates a fundamental learning problem. We can't learn from examples we don't see or remember. We celebrate the persistence of those who reach summits, but rarely acknowledge the wisdom of those who turn back when conditions become dangerous. Quitting is actually an essential decision-making tool in an uncertain world. The option to quit enables us to start things in the first place. Imagine if every decision was permanent. As we gain new information, quitting allows us to adjust course rather than remaining stuck. Silicon Valley's move fast and break things philosophy and minimum viable product approach only work because of the ability to quit what isn't working. Comedy legend Richard Pryor exemplified this at the Comedy Store, where he'd start with terrible material, ruthlessly quit what bombed, and develop what worked into Grammy-winning routines. Like dating before marriage, quitting is how we navigate uncertainty in all aspects of life. Paradoxically, while quitting helps us make good decisions under uncertainty, uncertainty itself makes quitting decisions difficult. The crucial difference between persevering and quitting is that only perseverance promises eventual certainty about how things would have turned out. This desire to know for sure, to avoid the what-ifs, acts like a siren song luring us toward potentially disastrous outcomes. The corporate landscape proves this point. Many once successful companies that advertised in Tom Brady's first Super Bowl in 2002 are now gone. AOL, Blockbuster, Circuit City, CompUSA, Gateway, Radio Shack, and Sears. Despite their resources and past success, they failed to quit their outdated business models on time. Blockbuster, for instance, refused to acquire Netflix and persisted with physical rentals while streaming technology advanced. Sustained success requires not just sticking to what worked before, but constantly surveying the changing landscape and being willing to adapt. Stuart Butterfield's journey illustrates a crucial insight. Quitting at the right time almost always feels premature. After his first gaming venture failed in 2004, he salvaged one feature to create Flickr, which sold to Yahoo for $25 million. Later, he launched a new game called Glitch with substantial venture backing. Despite having devoted users and experiencing 7% weekly growth, Butterfield shocked investors by deciding to shut down the operation while still having $6 million in the bank. His ability to peek into the future revealed that sustaining their growth rate would require 31 more weeks just to break even, with increasingly expensive user acquisition costs and declining conversion rates. Though the game had 5,000 devoted users playing 20-plus hours weekly, over 95% of new users abandoned it after less than 7 minutes. Even after implementing aggressive marketing that brought in 10,000 new accounts in a single weekend, Butterfield recognized the fundamental problem. They needed nearly 100 new users to gain just one paying customer. This decision freed resources and talent, ultimately leading to the development of Slack, their internal communications tool that later sold to Salesforce for $27.7 billion. The lesson? Effective quitting requires mental time travel to see beyond present circumstances, as the right moment to quit rarely feels urgent or necessary. To make effective quit or stick decisions, we must think in terms of expected value, EV. Whether evaluating business ventures, career paths, or personal relationships, EV helps determine if continuing a path will be positive or negative in the long run. Like poker players who fold mediocre hands despite occasional winning potential, good quitters recognize when the expected value of persisting becomes lower than the alternative. Dr. Sarah Alston Martinez's story perfectly illustrates this principle. After 16 years as an emergency room physician who loved her work, administrative responsibilities gradually overwhelmed her clinical practice. The mounting stress affected her health and family relationships. Her hair fell out, she couldn't sleep, and her daughter complained she was always on your phone. When considering a job offer from an insurance company, Sarah realized her decision came down to probabilities. Staying meant 100% certainty of continued unhappiness, while changing jobs offered at least some probability of satisfaction. Research by economist Stephen Levitt reinforces this approach. In 2013, he created a website where people could flip a virtual coin to help make difficult quitting decisions. Surprisingly, 20,000 people used it for major life choices, like whether to leave jobs or relationships. The fascinating result? Those who quit were significantly happier months later than those who stayed, regardless of whether they quit on their own or because the coin told them to. This reveals a crucial insight. What people perceive as close calls between quitting and persisting aren't actually close at all. Our psychology puts a heavy thumb on the scale favoring persistence. Our decision-making patterns reveal a fascinating asymmetry. We tend to quit too early when things are going well, but persist too long when things are going poorly. Behavioral scientist Colin Kammerer demonstrated this through his study of New York City cab drivers, who typically quit early on profitable days, once reaching a daily income goal, but persist through unprofitable shifts, trying to reach that same goal. This income target heuristic costs drivers significantly. They could earn 15% more by simply allocating their hours based on demand. This behavior stems from what Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky identified as loss aversion, the principle that losses feel about twice as painful as equivalent gains feel pleasurable. We prefer certainty when ahead, taking a guaranteed $100 rather than risking it on a coin flip for $200 nothing, but gamble when behind, risking owing $200 rather than paying a certain $100. Though both scenarios have identical expected values, $100, our psychology shifts dramatically based on whether we're in the gains or in the losses. This pattern appears consistently across domains. Retail traders frequently abandon their preset take profit orders, manually exiting positions early to lock in gains, while canceling stop loss orders when losing, hoping positions will recover. I observed similar behavior in poker players, who would quickly cash out when winning, but remain super glued to the seat when losing, even when tired, drunk, or playing poorly. This strategy directly harms financial outcomes by minimizing hours playing well and maximizing hours playing poorly. Even professional investors show surprising asymmetry in their decision quality. Research examining 700-plus institutional portfolio managers found their buying decisions outperformed market benchmarks by 120 basis points annually. However, their selling decisions performed worse than randomly selecting which holdings to sell, losing 70 to 80 basis points annually. The problem stems from a feedback gap. Investors naturally track positions they hold, but stop monitoring those they've exited, missing crucial data that could improve their quitting decisions. This asymmetry in our decision-making creates a fundamental feedback problem. While we naturally track activities we're engaged in, once we exit something, we lose visibility into how things would have gone had we stayed. Creating systems to track the performance of abandoned paths is essential for developing better quitting skills. Harold Staw's story illustrates the tragedy of escalating commitment. After successfully building ABC stores from a chicken coop into a major retail chain in Southern California during the 1950s-60s, Harold faced competition from Kmart that made his California stores unprofitable. Despite clear signals to quit, Texas shareholders revolting, his attorney switching sides, and even a buyout offer from Fred Meyer, Harold refused to let go of his failing stores. He ultimately lost everything except a single property lease, pouring his family's accumulated wealth into a doomed enterprise. His son, Barry, became a pioneering researcher studying why people persist in losing endeavors. His seminal 1976 paper, Knee Deep in the Big Muddy, explored this phenomenon, using the Vietnam War as a paradigmatic example of escalation of commitment, where decision makers respond to evidence of failure by increasing their investment rather than withdrawing. Despite clear warnings that the war was unwinnable, leaders doubled down, ultimately costing $200 billion, 58,000 American lives, and creating generational distrust in government. Even with low stakes, people demonstrate irrational commitment to losing courses of action. In Rubin and Brockner's experiment, participants worked on crossword puzzles for payment, with the option to request a dictionary that would never arrive. Remarkably, over half the participants waited beyond the point of no return, when their potential earnings dropped below what they could have secured by simply quitting. The sunk cost fallacy explains much of this behavior. A rational decision maker would only consider future costs and benefits, continuing only if expected value remains positive. Yet 40 years of research confirms that people factor in sunk costs, believing the only way to recover or justify previous expenses is to continue. Consider a concert. You'd decline a free ticket during freezing rain, but if you'd already spent $95 on a ticket, you'd likely go despite identical future conditions. As we invest time, money, and effort into endeavors, these accumulated costs make it progressively harder to quit. This self-reinforcing cycle creates a snowball effect. The more we've invested, the more committed we become, leading us to invest even more. We see this in everyday situations. Once we've waited in a slow grocery line, we rarely switch lines despite seeing faster ones nearby. Relationships follow the same pattern. The more time someone invests trying to fix a dysfunctional relationship, the less likely they are to end it. Astro Teller's approach at Google X revolves around identifying which projects to quit as quickly as possible. With limited resources, even at Alphamet, every dollar saved by abandoning failing projects can be redirected toward potentially world-changing innovations. To facilitate better quitting decisions, Teller developed the Monkeys and Pedestals mental model. When trying to train a monkey to juggle flaming torches while standing on a pedestal, the bottleneck isn't building the pedestal, which is easy and well understood, but training the monkey, the hard, potentially impossible part. The lesson is simple but profound. Tackle the hardest part of any problem first. Project Foghorn, X's initiative to convert seawater into fuel, exemplifies this approach. While they had proof of concept, commercial viability proved impossible. They needed to produce fuel at competitive prices, but existing desalination infrastructure couldn't meet production needs, and plummeting traditional fuel costs made their target unattainable. After identifying this insurmountable monkey, they shut down the project. Since we're poor at responding rationally to signals that we should quit, establishing kill criteria in advance can help us cut losses appropriately. These are specific conditions that, if met, trigger project termination, essentially creating a pre-commitment contract to quit. Research by Simonson and Staw demonstrated this approach's effectiveness. Participants who set minimum targets for sales and profits before making investment decisions allocated resources much more rationally when faced with poor performance data. The most effective kill criteria combined both states, objective measurable conditions, and dates, specific timeframes. This creates clear decision rules, like if I haven't achieved X by Y date, I'll quit. At M Particle, one criterion was, if I can't get an executive in the room by the next meeting, kill the deal. Even high-stakes operations use this approach. Admiral McRaven's raid on Bin Laden's compound had 162 phases with specific quit conditions, such as aborting if they fell an hour behind schedule or were compromised before reaching the halfway point. Even with well-established kill criteria, perfect execution isn't realistic, but imperfect application still improves decision-making. During my poker career, I set stop-loss limits, time boundaries, quitting after 6 to 8 hours, and game quality thresholds. Did I always follow them? No, sometimes I grabbed more money after hitting my loss limit or played for 24-plus hours straight. But having these guidelines made me better at quitting than I would have been otherwise. Andrew Wilkinson's Flow Saga illustrates how ownership blinds us to rational quitting. Despite Asana's superior funding and growing feature advantage, Wilkinson kept pouring money into Flow, $11 million over 12 years, while growth slowed from 20% to 5% monthly and bugs multiplied. He even rejected a $6 million acquisition offer because he'd invested $11 million, refusing to accept the loss. This demonstrates how ownership, especially of something we've created, dramatically interferes with our ability to walk away. Richard Thaler first identified this endowment effect, our tendency to value things we own more highly than identical items we don't possess. His economist friend refused to sell wine bottles for $100 each despite never paying more than $35 for wine, yet wouldn't buy additional bottles at that price either. Laboratory experiments consistently show this effect, with selling prices typically double what buyers would pay for identical items. The endowment effect extends beyond physical objects to our beliefs, ideas, and decisions. We become owners of our thoughts and commitments, valuing them more highly than others would. This effect intensifies with the IKEA effect. We value things we've built ourselves even more. This explains why pedestal building is dangerous. Not only do we create sunk costs when building something, but we become endowed to what we've built, making it doubly difficult to quit. Status quo bias amplifies our commitment to failing paths. We resist veering from established decisions and methods, viewing change as an active choice while seeing continuation as a non-decision. This asymmetry in thinking causes us to worry more about potential losses from changing course than the certain losses from staying put. We're more concerned with errors of commission than errors of omission, more afraid of causing a bad outcome through action than letting it happen through inaction. The hardest thing to quit is who you are. Sears, Roebuck & Co.'s journey from revolutionary mail-order catalog business in 1896 to bankruptcy in 2018 illustrates this perfectly. After thriving through catalog sales and retail stores, Sears built a thriving financial services empire, including Allstate Insurance, Dean Witter, Discover Card, and Coldwell Banker, assets worth over $16.6 billion by the early 1990s. Yet when forced to make strategic decisions, Sears chose to divest these successful businesses to reinvest in its failing retail operations, claiming it needed to get back to its retailing roots. The businesses Sears abandoned went on to thrive independently, while Sears itself eventually went bankrupt. Ron Conway, one of the greatest angel investors of all time, excels not just at picking winners, but at coaching founders on when to quit. His philosophy is simple: life's too short. Despite investing in legendary companies like Google, Facebook, and Airbnb, Conway recognizes that 90% of startups fail, making it crucial to help promising founders recognize when to move on. Conway's approach is masterful. He doesn't directly contradict founders' optimism when he sees their venture failing. Instead, he asks them to define specific benchmarks for success over the coming months, effectively establishing kill criteria with their input. This allows founders to maintain hope while creating a framework for rational decision-making later. Our culture deeply embeds the belief that optimism leads to achievement, evidenced by bestsellers like The Power of Positive Thinking and children's classics like The Little Engine That Could. But research by Don Moore and colleagues shows that while optimism makes people persist longer at tasks, it doesn't actually improve performance outcomes. In Silicon Valley, this unfettered optimism reaches delusional levels. 81% of founders believe they have a 70% or better chance of success, with a third believing success is guaranteed, despite only 10% of ventures generating positive returns. Daniel Kahneman believes everyone needs the friend who really loves them but does not care much about hurt feelings in the moment. When you're deep in a decision about whether to quit, your judgment is compromised by cognitive biases. Outside observers can see your situation more rationally, but often withhold hard truths to spare your feelings. This misplaced kindness actually harms you in the long run. True kindness means speaking unpleasant truths when someone is on a path they should abandon. For a quitting coach relationship to work effectively, explicit permission is essential. You must commit to being open to hearing hard truths, as Kahneman does with Thaler. Without this agreement, advisors typically default to cheerleading and reassurance rather than honest assessment. Even with permission, the best coaches help people reach their own conclusions rather than dictating decisions. Barry Staw's research on bank loan decisions reveals how powerful it is to separate initial approval from subsequent management of troubled loans. When banks allow the same person to handle both functions, they're more likely to throw good money after bad through escalating commitment. The person who approved the original loan feels responsible for its success and becomes biased toward continuing support. While organizations can implement this approach by dividing responsibilities, individuals can't split themselves in two, which is precisely why finding a quitting coach is so valuable. Maya Shanker's journey illustrates the hidden opportunities in forced quitting. After a torn tendon ended her promising violin career under Itzhak Perlman's tutelage, she discovered cognitive psychology at Yale, earned a Rhodes Scholarship, and completed a PhD at Oxford. Though initially devastated, this forced pivot revealed her dislike of solo work and eventually led her to found the White House Social and Behavioral Sciences team and later become Google's Global Director of Behavioral Science. My own path mirrors Shanker's forced pivot. At 26, I was on track to become an academic with prestigious job talks lined up when gastroparesis hospitalized me. Needing income during my health-mandated leave from graduate school, I turned to poker, something I'd only played recreationally during visits with my professional poker-playing brother. What began as a temporary solution, perfectly suited to my unpredictable health, flexible hours, no commitments, unexpectedly became an 18-year career that included winning a World Series of Poker championship bracelet. Life's uncertainty means our paths can change through external forces or our own evolving preferences. Ants demonstrate this wisdom perfectly. Even when they discover an abundant food source, like a fallen watermelon, some continue exploring for alternatives, knowing their current bounty could disappear. Unlike ants, humans often wait until forced to explore other options. The lesson is clear. We should always maintain some level of exploration, not waiting until we're forced to quit to discover better alternatives hiding in plain sight. The London Underground strike of 2014 provides a perfect example of how forced quitting can lead to better outcomes. When 171 of 270 stations closed during a 48-hour strike, 70% of commuters had to find alternative routes. Remarkably, about 5% permanently switched to their new routes after discovering they saved an average of 6 minutes per journey, a 20% reduction in commute time. These better routes were available all along, but commuters had settled into their status quo paths and stopped exploring. Diversification not only provides a safety net if you're forced to quit, but helps you make more rational decisions about walking away from something no longer worth pursuing. It's easier to quit when you know what you're walking toward. Having options gives you a chance to make better choices about what to quit and stick with. What you think is a backup plan will often become your plan A. Marathon runners who continue despite broken bones demonstrate the dangerous myopia that goals can create. When faced with a finish line, we often disregard pain, injury, and common sense because success is binary. You either cross the line or fail. The 2019 London Marathon saw multiple runners continue for miles with broken bones, prioritizing completion over their health and future ability to run. While setting specific, challenging goals has proven benefits, motivating persistence and providing direction, goals also have a dark side. Their pass-fail nature can trigger escalation of commitment and prevent rational quitting. The binary nature of goals creates a painful paradox. Abandoning a goal after significant progress, like quitting a marathon at mile 16, often feels worse than never having attempted it at all. As Richard Thaler quipped, if a gold medal in the Olympics is the only grade that passes, you do not want to ever take your first gymnastics class. Goals become problematic because they remain fixed while everything around them changes. When we initially set goals, we make trade-offs between competing values, balancing what we want to achieve against what we're willing to sacrifice. However, once established, goals transform from flexible proxies for our values into rigid endpoints. The original cost-benefit analysis that informed the goal becomes frozen, even as our knowledge, preferences, and circumstances evolve. To counter the rigidity of goals while preserving their motivational power, we should build flexibility through unlesses, specific conditions under which we'll abandon a goal. These kill criteria might respond to external signals, physical warnings, or internal changes. Effective unlesses require pre-commitment contracts and regular reevaluation of our underlying values and priorities. We need to stop measuring ourselves solely by how far we are from the finish line and start giving ourselves credit for how far we've come from the starting point. The rigid pass-fail mentality around goals causes us to discount progress made before reaching the finish line. By marking and celebrating achievements along the path, like viewing a silver medal as a huge accomplishment rather than a failure to get gold, we can better appreciate our journey. Our fixation on achieving goals causes a dangerous form of tunnel vision that prevents us from seeing alternative paths or opportunities. Like participants in the famous Invisible Gorilla experiment who failed to notice a person in a gorilla suit walking through a basketball game because they were focused on counting passes, we become blind to possibilities right in front of us. We resist quitting because we fear we've failed and wasted our resources, but we need to redefine what failure and waste mean. Quitting something no longer worth pursuing isn't failure, it's success. True failure is continuing to pursue the wrong goal. Similarly, waste isn't about resources already spent, which are sunk costs, but about continuing to spend additional resources on something no longer worthwhile. Winners quit a lot. That's how they win. Contrary to popular belief, the path of greatest expected value throughout our lives will involve significant quitting.